Chapter 20. Home at Last. Home is the resort of love, of joy, of peace and plenty, where supporting and supported, polished friends and dear relations mingle into bliss. James Thompson, The Seasons. Winter was slow to leave Philadelphia in 1797, much to the chagrin of George and Martha Washington. After John Adams's inauguration, they waited a few more days for the weather to clear before starting back to Mount Vernon. Washington used the spare time to catch up on his correspondence. On Monday, March 6th, he wrote Sir John Sinclair, informing him that he was leaving Philadelphia for a more tranquil theater and for the indulgence of rural pursuits. The purpose of this particular letter was to send Sinclair a copy of Richard Peters's Agricultural Inquiries on Plaster of Paris and some related pamphlets. In Washington's words, Peters was one of the most intelligent and best practical as well as theoretical farmers we have. This pamphlet formed the fullest discussion of gypsum as a fertilizer Washington had ever read. Without naming the titles of the other enclosed pamphlets, he said that the agricultural writers in This Infant Country were finally providing essays that could contribute to the advancement of agricultural science. Since Sinclair had been sending him numerous British books and pamphlets on the subject for the past 5 years, Washington was pleased to respond in kind. Like Washington, Sinclair was dedicated to the advancement of useful knowledge, a goal he had been actively pursuing since a lengthy tour of Europe in the mid-1780s. On his trip, Sinclair had developed a passion for discovering and disseminating practical information in many fields of knowledge, including and especially agriculture. Returning to his native Scotland in 1790, he initiated extensive surveys of the economy, geography, history, and social conditions of every Scottish parish, collectively designed to serve as a guide for future development. A massive undertaking, his Statistical Account of Scotland would eventually fill 21 volumes. Huge as it was, this project could not exhaust Sinclair's almost limitless energies. In the coming years, he founded organizations and initiated projects for the public good. In 1791, for example, he launched the British Wool Society, an organization founded to develop the quality of sheep throughout Great Britain. In 1793, Sinclair established the British Board of Agriculture. He served as its president but refused a salary, magnanimously devoting what he would have been paid to useful projects instead. Arthur Young, another prominent agricultural writer who corresponded with Washington, served as secretary. The Board of Agriculture conducted experiments, disseminated pertinent information, and sponsored legislation to benefit agricultural development. Under its auspices, Sinclair initiated the General Views series, a set of county surveys throughout Great Britain. To spread his ideas beyond the British Isles, he corresponded with influential figures he met on his European tour and boldly contacted many world leaders, including George Washington. Sinclair first wrote President Washington in May 1792, introducing himself, asking about wool production in the United States, and sending him some of his latest publications. Washington was grateful for the books. Precisely which titles Sinclair sent that year are uncertain, but when he edited and published his correspondence toward the end of his life, he provided some context. Upon starting his Statistical Account of Scotland, Sinclair had resolved to send copies of the first volumes to several distinguished characters in foreign countries. The initial exchange of letters between Sinclair and Washington marked the start of a rich and full correspondence. The following year, Sinclair sent a copy of Specimens of Statistical Reports, exhibiting the progress of political society from the pastoral state to that of luxury and refinement, which essentially formed a how-to guide for collecting the kind of local statistics Sinclair considered the first step toward improving the national infrastructure. Washington agreed with Sinclair's approach. Thanking him for the book, he approved of his plan to gather useful statistics for the betterment of society. Washington observed, "When enlightened men will take the trouble to examine so minutely into the state of society as your inquiries seem to go, it must result in greatly ameliorating the condition of the people, promoting the interests of civil society, and the happiness of mankind at large." His appreciative remarks encouraged Sinclair. After founding the Board of Agriculture, he sent Washington copies of its publications, accompanied by letters urging him to do whatever he could to establish a similar board in the United States. Washington's efforts to create a U.S. Board of Agriculture during his presidency were largely inspired by Sinclair, who kept a steady stream of books and pamphlets flowing from London to Philadelphia. Washington had little leisure time when he was president, but he did read some of the works Sinclair sent. He especially enjoyed the plan for the General Views series. Sinclair would send Washington additional titles in the series as they were published. From James Anderson's General View of the Agriculture and Rural Economy of the County of Aberdeen to Arthur Young's General View of the Agriculture of the County of Suffolk, dozens of volumes reached Washington's hands. And in 1795, Sinclair made Washington an honorary member of the Board of Agriculture. The letters they exchanged are not only the letters of two public-minded men discussing plans for the improvement of society. They also strike a personal note. Writing to Sinclair in mid-December 1796, Washington looked forward to his retirement from the presidency, a time when he would be able to read the books Sinclair had sent, to peruse, he said, "with pleasure and edification, the fruits of your meritorious labors for the improvement of agriculture." He would also begin experimenting with some of Sinclair's innovative agricultural methods. In short, Washington looked forward to retirement, when he could read about and experiment with new ideas, the kind of practical ideas Sinclair advocated. The message Washington sent Sinclair from Philadelphia while waiting for the weather to clear in early March 1797 anticipates the literary and agricultural pursuits he intended for retirement. Thursday the 9th was as cold as Valley Forge, but the Washingtons could wait no longer. George and Martha Washington left Philadelphia accompanied by Nellie Custis, George Washington Lafayette, the Marquis de Lafayette's son, who had been living with his namesake at the presidential mansion, and Felix Frestel, young Lafayette's tutor. Nellie's brother Wash was currently attending the College of New Jersey, Princeton. Before leaving town, George Washington arranged for Tobias Lear to come to Philadelphia and supervise the packing and shipping of their belongings. Having left President Washington's service after the death of his wife in 1793, Lear had organized a company to speculate in land near the new Federal City, which would become known as Washington, D.C. He later served as president of the Potomac Canal Company. Lear was happy to take a break from his business activities to help his old friend and mentor. Washington's instructions to Lear revealed that he did not want to withdraw himself fully from the political scene in his retirement. Hoping to stay informed, he instructed Lear to purchase any new pamphlets and bring them to him. Given the cold, wet winter, the Washingtons dreaded the road conditions between Philadelphia and Mount Vernon. Though some roads were quite bad, overall they proved better than expected. Regardless, the journey was, in Nellie Custis's words, tedious and fatiguing. The unruly crowds may have slowed them down more than the muddy roads. Every town and city they entered welcomed the Washingtons with fanfare and fol-de-rol. They paused in the Federal District to observe the construction of the U.S. Capitol and the White House. Both seemed to be taking longer and costing more than expected. In addition, private housing was almost non-existent. When a foreign visitor wondered where all the lawmakers and politicians would live, Washington came back with a witty reply. "Oh, well," he joked, "they can camp out. The representatives in the first line, the Senate in the second, the president with all his suite in the middle." Leaving the Federal District, they crossed the Potomac and soon reached Mount Vernon, arriving 7 days after they had left Philadelphia. Writing to a friend to inform her of their safe arrival, Nellie Custis expressed George Washington's feelings upon returning home the best. "Grandpapa is very well and much pleased with being once more Farmer Washington." Letter writing made less of a demand on Washington during retirement than it had when he was president, but he would correspond regularly with many intellectuals in the United States and Great Britain. Besides John Sinclair, Washington would maintain a correspondence with other prominent British agricultural writers, including James Anderson and Arthur Young. All would send him additional books inspiring new agricultural projects at Mount Vernon. Sinclair looked toward ideas that could contribute to large-scale agricultural innovation. He sent books that could help get things done. Though Washington had been unable to establish a U.S. Board of Agriculture during his administration, he had not abandoned the idea. Neither had Sinclair, who sent him several copies of his Account of the Origin of the Board of Agriculture and Its Progress for 3 years after its establishment, one to keep, and others to distribute to those who might help influence the establishment of a similar American board. Washington was so busy during his first spring and summer back home that he did not have time to read the English and Scottish county surveys Sinclair had sent, or, for that matter, any of the other books he had planned to read during his retirement. Before leaving Philadelphia, he told James McHenry, his Secretary of War, how much he looked forward to reading in retirement. But when he wrote to describe his daily routine, he initially made no mention of books. Realizing that McHenry would think the omission strange, Washington added, "Having given you the history of a day, it will serve for a year, and I am persuaded you will not require a second edition of it. But it may strike you that in this detail no mention is made of any portion of time allotted for reading. The remark would be just, for I have not looked into a book since I came home, nor shall be able to do it until I have discharged my workmen, probably not before the nights grow longer, when possibly I may be looking in Doomsday Book." Though Washington could not find much time for reading early in his retirement, he did start reorganizing his books. His correspondence indicates that he devoted a fair amount of time to putting his personal library in order. Gathering the individual volumes of multi-volume sets, he noticed some gaps and sought to fill them. Though he had received many books in Sinclair's General Views series, for example, he was unsure whether he had received all of them. He wrote Sinclair, hoping to complete his collection. "It is my intention to have them classed and bound neatly." Washington also grew curious about the status of another major multi-volume work published over a period of several years. He wondered whether Thomas Dobson had ever completed his Encyclopedia. Dobson had not, at least not yet. That the Encyclopedia remained a work in progress is understandable. It was far and away the most ambitious project Dobson had undertaken since emigrating from Scotland, settling in Philadelphia, and establishing himself as one of the city's leading publishers and booksellers. Washington had often patronized Dobson's shop during his presidency, using him as both a stationer and a bookbinder. Dobson became best known for publishing American editions of the most important books coming out of Great Britain. In 1789, Dobson published a 3-volume American edition of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, the edition Washington owned. Also that same year, Dobson advertised his proposal for an American edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Not only would Dobson's encyclopedia be his most ambitious undertaking, it was also the most ambitious work ever undertaken in the United States by any publisher to that time. Unlike his edition of The Wealth of Nations, it would not be a verbatim reprint of the British text. Dobson planned to make the encyclopedia uniquely American, with hundreds of original copperplate illustrations engraved by American artists and many new articles on American themes. In addition, several of the articles from the London edition would be rewritten with an American slant. Emphasizing his encyclopedia as an American venture in the proposals he circulated, Dobson sought to attract subscribers from throughout the nation. Though many book buyers were interested in the project, Dobson still faced a considerable challenge. Upon learning about Dobson's plan for publishing an encyclopedia, Washington called him a bold man, but nevertheless gave the project every encouragement. To help encourage Dobson's encyclopedia, he subscribed for 2 sets, another example of his literary patronage while president. The first volume appeared in 1790, but it would take nearly a decade for its publisher to complete the work, which ran to a total of 18 volumes, not counting the supplements. Washington gave 1 set to Tobias Lear, a handsome reward for all the work Lear had done for him. Washington finally received his copy of Dobson's Encyclopedia in 1798. Presentation copies continued to reach Philadelphia even after Washington had left. One day, Timothy Pickering, who remained Secretary of State under John Adams, received a visit from Joseph Nancreed. A Boston printer and publisher, Nancreed brought with him a copy of Bernardin de Saint-Pierre's Studies of Nature, which he had recently issued in an English translation. Nancreed dedicated this first American edition of Bernardin's work to Washington, though without his permission. To enhance the gift, Nancreed had this presentation copy handsomely bound in red morocco and elegantly gilt. Washington received far more books than he had the time or the inclination to read. He was less likely to read a work like Bernardin's than those he received from Sinclair, Anderson, and Young, that is, works providing practical information he could put to use on his farms. The subject of Bernardin's Studies of Nature had appealed to Washington in his youth, but it contained little to interest him in old age. Bernardin studied natural history in an effort to demonstrate the existence of God. In terms of general content and philosophical outlook, Bernardin's Studies of Nature was reactionary. It contained nothing Washington had not read decades earlier in John Ray's Wisdom of God. No doubt the 3 volumes of Gilt Morocco looked good in the library at Mount Vernon, but once Washington put them on the shelf, one suspects, he never took them off. Another book Pickering sent to Mount Vernon, Washington did read carefully. James Monroe's View of the Conduct of the Executive of the United States. When Washington asked Pickering to send him a copy of this controversial book in January, he also asked his opinion of it. In his cover letter, Pickering said that Monroe's book is considered by everyone whom I have heard speak of it as his own condemnation, or, as some have expressed themselves, his death warrant. This book, largely a collection of documents, represents Monroe's attempt to vindicate his public conduct as U.S. Minister to France during Washington's administration. Washington had appointed him to the post in May 1794. A protege of Thomas Jefferson, Monroe was opposed to Federalist policies, but Washington made the appointment as a conciliatory gesture to France. By appointing a Republican partisan, he hoped to reassure the French of continuing friendship with the United States. Monroe was responsible for defending Jay's treaty to the French government, a difficult task for any ambassador, let alone one who disagreed with the treaty. 2 years into Monroe's appointment, Washington recalled him. Monroe did not return to Philadelphia until June 1797, after which he prepared a detailed defense of his official actions as ambassador. Benjamin Franklin Bache, who had continued to attack Washington even after he left office, was happy to publish Monroe's screed. His copy of Monroe's View is unique among Washington's books for the vast amount of marginalia it contains. Formerly, he had written in his books to correct errors, mainly typographical ones. His marginalia in Monroe's View can also be seen as corrections, but they go far beyond correcting factual errors. None of Washington's other marginalia reveal his emotions as he read, but what he wrote in the margins of Monroe's View clearly indicates his anger. He was genuinely hurt by Monroe's comments, but, ever concerned with the good of the nation, he also saw them as threats to the American government. As his editors observe, Washington's marginal comments in Monroe's View comprise the most extended, unremitting, and pointed use of taunts and jibes, sarcasm, and scathing criticism in all of his writings. Washington's marginal comments in the volume are largely restricted to Monroe's introduction. The documents section of his copy contains comparatively little marginalia. Washington's belligerence is clear from the start. Monroe's introduction begins with the following sentence. In the month of May 1794, I was invited by the President of the United States, through the Secretary of State, to accept the office of Minister Plenipotentiary to the French Republic. Washington's marginalia begin with a sarcastic phrase modifying Monroe's opening sentence. After several attempts had failed to obtain a more eligible character, Monroe continued, it had been too my fortune in the course of my service as a U.S. Senator to differ from the administration upon many of our most important public measures. Washington responded with a rhetorical question. Is this adduced as conclusive evidence that the administration was in an error? When President Washington had sent David Humphreys across the Atlantic to negotiate a treaty between the United States and Algiers, Humphreys stopped in Paris to speak with Monroe and see if France, which was at peace with Algiers, could help negotiate the treaty. Understanding the tensions between the United States and France, Monroe hesitated to approach the French government on Humphreys's behalf, especially since Humphreys had brought no letters from the Washington administration authorizing him to make an arrangement with the French regarding Algiers. Monroe explained his attitude toward this issue in his introduction, but Washington did not buy it. Monroe seemed to think that every decision he made was the right one. Reading the introduction, Washington found Monroe obsessed with his own opinions and reluctant to consider other viewpoints. As he read Monroe's self-righteous explanation of the Algiers situation, Washington inscribed from memory the following snippet of verse. And he wrote to his father, ending with this line, I am, my lovely Nevia, ever thine. These lines come from an epigram by Marshall that Washington had first read in The Spectator in his youth. Using this couplet to characterize Monroe's behavior, Washington cast him as someone whose obsessions had led him into inadvertent error. Reading Monroe's View in February or early March 1798, Washington read about issues that still affected the United States. During John Adams's administration, tensions with France continued to escalate. In May 1798, Adams approved the formation of a provisional army to be activated in case of French invasion. The first week of July, the president commissioned Washington as lieutenant general and commander of the army. He had not told Washington about the commission beforehand. Washington was shocked to learn about the appointment in the papers. Suddenly, all his well-earned rest, all his hard-fought leisure seemed to disappear before his eyes. Once the news sank in, remarkably, Washington accepted the position. He informed John Trumbull, using a favorite metaphor, "When I bid adieu last to the theater of public life, I thought it was hardly possible that any event would arise in my day that could induce me to tread that stage again. But this is an age of wonders, and I have once more consented to become an actor in the great drama." Washington had one proviso. He would only accept the position if he could choose his officers and staff. He selected Alexander Hamilton as second in command and Tobias Lear as his military secretary with the rank of colonel. Adams, who had long butted heads with Hamilton, had difficulty accepting him as Washington's second in command, but he eventually acquiesced, knowing full well that he could only have Washington if he took Hamilton with him. In November, Washington left Mount Vernon for Philadelphia to consult with Hamilton and direct the planning of a new army. They devoted much time and effort considering possible officers for the provisional army. But Washington returned to Mount Vernon by Christmas. All the work and personal conflict involved with selecting officers for the new army proved unnecessary. In February 1799, Adams announced his decision to send a peace commission to France. The prospect of war with France dissipated, and the possibility of Washington continuing to serve as commander-in-chief disappeared. The happiest outcome of the experience for Washington may have been his reunion with Tobias Lear. Though no longer needing a military secretary, Washington did need a personal secretary. He offered the position to Lear, who accepted it and moved to Mount Vernon. February 22, 1799, marked Washington's 67th birthday. The event was minor compared with the celebration that took place at Mount Vernon that same day. Nellie Custis married Washington's nephew, Lawrence Lewis. At 20, Nellie had already accepted that she would be a prim, starched spinster, but Lewis captured her heart. Though Nellie's life was going well, her brother Wash seemed destined to follow the same pattern of behavior as their father, Jack Custis, much to George Washington's chagrin. After being unable to give his lackadaisical stepson the ideal education he envisioned, Washington now found that his step-grandson similarly disdained a proper education. Expelled from Princeton for repeated misconduct, Wash transferred to St. John's College in Annapolis, but dropped out before finishing his studies. At the time of his sister's wedding, Wash's future remained uncertain. After the excitement of the wedding, George Washington, his wife Martha, and Tobias Lear settled into a regular routine at Mount Vernon. Every day, Washington rode around his farms to keep an eye on his crops, livestock, and agricultural experiments. He took these daily rounds regardless of the weather. On Thursday, December 12th, for example, he set off on the daily tour of his plantations, though the thick cloud cover had an ominous look. Rain began to fall and gradually changed to snow, but Washington continued his ride. He returned home covered with snow, but seeing he had guests for dinner, did not bother to change clothes. The next day, Friday the 13th, it snowed another 3 inches. This time Washington skipped his daily tour of the farms, but he did brave the snow to mark some trees he wanted cut down. That evening, George and Martha Washington, along with Tobias Lear, settled themselves in the parlor to catch up on the news, the latest papers having arrived from the post office. Newspaper reading had long been a regular activity at Mount Vernon. Washington subscribed to several papers, some of which he had bound into volumes to form a permanent part of his collection. His library catalog lists the Gazette of the United States, the Pennsylvania Gazette, and the Pennsylvania Packet. That Friday, as usual, Lear and the Washingtons read silently. But whenever George met with an article that caught his attention or captured his fancy, he would read it to the others. As he read aloud that evening, his voice sounded a little hoarse. With all the recent snow, he was apparently coming down with a cold. His sore throat prevented Washington from reading aloud as much as he wished, so he asked Lear to read the debates of the Virginia Assembly regarding the nomination of James Monroe to the office of Virginia governor. Monroe's view, it turned out, was not the death warrant Pickering had predicted. Virginians had mixed feelings about Monroe. Some state legislators believed that his mission to France had hurt the reputation of the United States abroad. Electing him governor, they argued, would send the message that Washington had been wrong to recall him. James Madison, on the other hand, spoke eloquently in Monroe's defense. At Mount Vernon that evening, Lear read aloud what Madison had to say in the legislature. Madison saw no reason to delay Monroe's gubernatorial nomination. The matter had already been investigated thoroughly. Any further delay would reduce Monroe to a singular and disturbing dilemma. Ambassadors could be recalled for reasons unconnected to their diplomatic character. Sometimes they had been remanded without being censured. Was Monroe to be banned from serving the nation on vague suspicions? Madison found Monroe's private character pure and his public character unimpeachable. His argument carried the day, and Monroe was elected governor of Virginia. Once Lear finished reading, Washington appeared much affected and spoke with some degree of asperity on the subject. As Washington spoke, his voice sounded worse. When Lear commented on his hoarseness, Washington admitted his throat was sore, but made light of the situation. "You know I never take anything for a cold," he said. "Let it go as it came." He seemed cheerful enough. Shortly after 9 o'clock that evening, Washington went to bed, apparently in good health, except for the cold. Around 2 o'clock that morning, he woke Martha, telling her he was quite sick. He feared he had an ague. A vague term that has since fallen from medical usage, ague referred to something much more serious than a cold. It involved such symptoms as fever, shivering, and shaking. Washington had escaped injury on the battlefield so often that it seemed shocking to learn he was not ague-proof. He could hardly speak now and breathed with difficulty. Caroline, a house servant, entered their bedroom at daybreak to light a fire. By this time, Washington realized his condition was urgent. He might not be able to wait until a doctor arrived. He asked Caroline to fetch George Rollins, an overseer who had often doctored the slaves when they were sick. On her way out, Caroline stopped by Lear's room and apprised him of the situation. Lear dressed quickly and went to the Washington's bedroom. Washington tried to explain his condition, but he was short of breath, and it seemed could hardly utter a word. Lear dashed off a note to Dr. Craik, dispatching a messenger to ride to Alexandria and bring the doctor back as quickly as he could. Lear returned to the Washington's chamber, where someone prepared a folk remedy to soothe his sore throat. Washington could not swallow this mixture of butter, molasses, and vinegar, which made him gag. Rawlins arrived soon after sunrise. Washington asked Rawlins to bleed him. This long-standing therapy was based on the antiquated notion that illness stemmed from an imbalance of the four humors. Bloodletting supposedly cured illness by rebalancing the humors. Rawlins had bled six slaves before, but bleeding the most respected man in America made him nervous. Washington could tell.
"Don't be afraid," Washington whispered.
After Rawlins made the incision, the blood flowed slowly.
"The orifice is not large enough," his distinguished patient told him.
It seemed plenty large to Martha Washington, who sensibly worried whether bloodletting was the right therapy in her husband's case. She begged Lear to halt the procedure. Lear tried to stop it, but Washington insisted Rawlins continue until he had taken a pint of blood. Needless to say, the loss of blood did not help Washington's condition. He still could not swallow. Lear proposed bathing the throat externally with salve, but that only irritated it further. Instead, they covered his neck with a piece of flannel. Next, for some odd reason, they soaked his feet in warm water. Growing anxious as they waited for Dr. Craik, Martha asked Lear to send for Dr. Gustavus Brown, who lived across the river at Port Tobacco, Maryland. Craik arrived at around 9 o'clock. After examining Washington, he applied a paste made from cantharides to his throat and then bled him again. The prescription seems positively medieval. Cantharides was a powder made from dried beetles. In addition, Craik had some vinegar and hot water put into a tea kettle to serve as a vaporizer. Craik also had some sage tea and vinegar mixed for a gargle. Washington tried to use it, but the gargle almost suffocated him. As the solution came out of his mouth, it brought up some phlegm, a good sign. Craik encouraged Washington to keep coughing to bring up some more phlegm, but to no avail. After 2 hours, Craik sent for more help, dispatching a servant to fetch Dr. Elisha Dick, another Alexandria physician. While waiting, Craik bled Washington again, the third time, but his throat did not improve. Craik next administered a glister, another attempt to rebalance the humors. The glister produced an evacuation but did nothing to improve the throat infection. Dr. Dick arrived around 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon. After Craik consulted with Dick, they bled Washington for a fourth time. By now, they had removed over a third of the volume of blood in his body. When Dr. Brown arrived, he entered Washington's chamber and took his pulse. The three physicians left the room together to discuss the case. The situation recalls a comment by Thomas Jefferson, who disagreed with bloodletting and who put much less stock in physicians than Washington. Jefferson joked that, "Whenever he saw three physicians together, he looked up to discover whether there was not a turkey buzzard in the neighborhood." By 4 o'clock, Washington could swallow a little, but he could tell his situation was dire. He asked his wife to retrieve the two wills from his desk and bring them to him. He told her to burn the old one and save the new one, the one he had drafted earlier that year, which would free his slaves upon her death. She followed his instructions, placing the old will into the fire.
"I find I am going. My breath cannot last long," Washington said to Lear late that afternoon. "I believed from the first that the disorder would prove fatal."
Maintaining his equanimity, he gave Lear some instructions regarding his letters, papers, and financial accounts. During the afternoon, Lear could tell that Washington was in great pain, partly because of his difficulty breathing, but also because of his difficulty adjusting his position on the bed. Occasionally, Lear would lie on the bed next to him, using his own body to lift Washington's and turn him as gently as possible. Lear performed these movements easily, willingly, simply, and with a goodness of heart that touched Washington.
"I am afraid I shall fatigue you too much," Washington said.
Lear assured him he felt nothing but a wish to comfort him.
"Well, it is a debt we must pay to each other, and I hope when you want aid of this kind you will find it," Washington replied.
At 5 o'clock the three physicians returned. Craik asked Washington if he could sit up in bed. Lear took his hand and helped raise him to a sitting position. Washington seemed resigned to his fate. He lay back down. Dick and Brown left the room, but Craik and Lear stayed by his bedside.
"Doctor, I die hard, but I am not afraid to go," Washington said. "I believe from my first attack that I should not survive it. My breath cannot last long."
Craik pressed his hand, but could not utter a word. He left the bedside and took a seat by the fire, absorbed in grief. The other two physicians returned around 8 that evening, but left the room, as Lear said, without a ray of hope. About 10 o'clock, Washington attempted to speak. It took several tries, but he was finally able to say something.
"I am just going," he said.
Premature burial was a common fear of the time, so Washington gave instructions to prevent being buried alive.
"Have me decently buried, and do not let my body be put into the vault in less than 2 days after I am dead."
Lear nodded his head.
"Do you understand me?" Washington asked.
"Yes, sir," Lear said.
"'Tis well," he said.
Lear continued to hold his hand. Toward 11, Washington's breathing became easier. He withdrew his hand from Lear's to reach across his body and feel his own pulse. Lear called Craik, still seated by the fire, to come to the bedside. As Washington was taking his own pulse, his arm went limp. Lear grabbed hold of his hand as it started to fall and placed it upon his breast. Washington expired without a sigh or a struggle. Craik reached out and closed his eyelids.
"Is he gone?" Martha asked.
Choked with sobs, Lear could not speak, but he held up his hand to indicate her husband was gone.
"'Tis well," she replied with resignation. "'Tis all now over. I have no more trials to pass through. I shall soon follow him."
George Washington's death, like everyone's, required some basic clerical tasks. For one thing, his estate had to be inventoried. As was common in the 18th century, the books were inventoried volume by volume. His library contained more than 1,000 volumes, encompassing perhaps a third as many more titles with all the pamphlets taken into account. A man's library, it has been said, is a window to his soul. Because so many of the books Washington acquired during the last decade and a half of his life were presentation copies, his library may reveal less about the inner man than, say, the libraries of Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin. Yet the inventory of Washington's library that was taken upon his death does permit some conclusions. Washington's library reflects his practical bent. Most of the books he acquired late in life were highly useful works. Dictionaries and encyclopedias provided references he could dip into whenever he needed specific information. His collection of military books, perhaps the finest in revolutionary America, seems remarkably purposeful. He did not read military books as a hobby. He expanded his military library during times of war, but added few volumes to it in times of peace. His collection of law books, tiny compared with the typical library of the 18th-century Virginia gentleman, consisted mainly of practical works, too. When Washington wrote the landmark will that freed his slaves, he did so without consulting an attorney. His law books alone gave him guidance. The few theoretical works in his legal collection treated the laws of nature and nations, which contained the fundamental theories that formed the basis of the U.S. government. History and travel, two of the largest subject areas in Washington's library at Mount Vernon, proved ideal for recreational reading. Washington accepted the long-standing notion that literature must both delight and instruct. Travels offered exciting, action-packed narratives that nonetheless informed readers about geography and customs from around the world. Histories presented narratives of the past that could be used to shape the future. They let pragmatic readers like Washington know what to emulate and what to avoid. Biographies, in turn, presented patterns of behavior readers could use to shape their own. The narrative aspect of travels and histories enhanced their readability, but another type of narrative, the novel, was largely absent from the library shelves at Mount Vernon. Washington did own such classics as Don Quixote, Gil Blas, and the picaresque English novels they inspired, but otherwise his library contained few novels. Washington had trouble reading fiction, that is, narratives lacking useful information. Agricultural treatises like those John Sinclair sent to him never seemed to tire Washington. Viewed as literature, the novel and the agricultural treatise are polar opposites. The novel presents a narrative but lacks practical information. The agricultural treatise contains practical information but has no narrative. Or does it? Though agricultural treatises may lack any explicit narratives, they do have implicit ones. Forward-thinking readers like Washington could read an agricultural treatise with an eye toward what would happen once its schemes were put into practice. Instead of telling what has already happened, it foreshadows what will happen. The best agricultural treatises, like many of the other books in George Washington's life, project a vision for the future. This has been a Highbridge production, read by David Colacci. Copyright 2017 by Oxford University Press. Published by arrangement with Oxford University Press. Recording copyright 2019 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.